Welcome back to Railway Mania. Our guest for this episode has written numerous books on trains and railways, and his latest publication is All Aboard, published by Times Books. It's my great pleasure to introduce Julian Holland. Welcome to the show, Julian.
Hello. Hello, Corwin.
Something that I ask everyone who comes on the podcast is, where did this lifelong love of railways begin for you?
How many hours do you have? I'll be brief. When I was very young, I lived opposite the old Midland Railway main line from Gloucester to Bristol. I lived in Gloucester. So that was just across the road. Behind us, we had the old Midland Railway High Orchard branch down to Gloucester Docks and the Gloucester Carriage and Wagon Company. And I used to see all the trains coming up there like new Airfix kits. You know, there were carriages for Nigerian Railways and underground stock for London Transport, diesel multiple units, rail cars. My father, when I was young, built me, or was it for himself, a large O-gauge railway in the attic of our house. So I was slightly indoctrinated by railways from a very early age. And even when I went to junior school, I had to cross in a level crossing to get to school, and invariably the gates would be closed, and you know, I'd see a train coming up or down, and it's great. I mean, I loved it.
I do think that that's quite interesting. Something that's a theme in your book, certainly, is that things that would be an inconvenience for other people to a railway enthusiast are just brilliant moments.
Yeah.
So, say for example, having to change trains, it's like, oh, great, we get to see two forms of motive power or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I love it. You were talking about changing trains, and I'm going off a bit off on a limb here, but I do remember, and this was about 1963, we travelled from Gloucester to Lyme Regis for our holiday. My dad didn't have a car. Great. And we had to go from Gloucester to Mangotsfield, change trains, Mangotsfield to Bath Green Park, change trains, Bath Green Park to Templecombe, change trains, Templecombe to Axminster, change trains, and Axminster to Lyme Regis. And do you know what? In August 1963, we did this all by steam.
That's five changes.
Yeah.
I guess today that would just be one car journey. So.
Yeah, really boring.
Magic for a railway enthusiast.
Yeah.
So a lot of your book focuses on the sort of end of steam, the changeover from steam to diesel that finished in 1968. Do you feel that witnessing the demise of the railway empires of Britain with the beaching cuts and everything and the demise of steam power, did that make you want to preserve it on the page?
Oh, definitely. Most of them. I mean, I was fortunate to see the end of steam and the start of the diesel invasion, as I call it. Looking back on it now, I got really excited by seeing the first Hi-Mec diesel, you know, D7000. I thought, wow, and warships and westerns. I mean, compared to what we've got on the railways now, they're pretty attractive looking machines.
Yeah, and now people are even getting nostalgic about the machines which replaced them.
Yeah, I know.
Every generation has its ones that they really like.
Yeah.
Lament losing.
I mean, they're preserving HSTs. Mm. Well, I remember when they came out. I just couldn't believe it. Traveling 125 miles an hour between Paddington and Swindon was unheard of.
Yeah. And when did you begin to write about railways?
Well, what happened was I've always been in publishing, but on the creative side. So I never wrote. And I had a lot of experience working for major publishers in London. And I was art director and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we designed the book. That was my core interest. And it was all done pre-computers by cow gum and strips of paper. And I got very good at that. I got to 2004 and I had a serious illness in Scotland, in Aberdeen Hospital. And I nearly died. And I'd found my work very stressful. And I sort of had a thought, like all on the road to Damascus, I have to change my career. Still within publishing, a very good friend of mine was a commissioning editor at David and Charles at the time, and he gave me my first contract, and the book did very well, and I didn't really look back. And I think I've had about 40 books published.
Wow. Incredible.
This just shows how old I am.
and how well that epiphany worked out for you. Being in hospital and realising that you have to change career and actually being able to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it was difficult to start with because the money wasn't so good. And it takes a while to build up a backlist, you know, and you hopefully, if it sells well, you get royalties for that. But in the early days, I really struggled financially.
Mm.
But it was worth it, I suppose, you know.
Yes, I guess everything like that is a labour of love when you first start out doing it. But you kind of have to stick with it.
And you know, I count myself so lucky that a lot of people my age are retired, fiddling around in the garden, going for walks. And I like doing that as well, don't get me wrong. But I consider myself really lucky to still have that career.
Yeah.
It's great.
Coming forward to your newest publication, which is The Times All Aboard, I think it's a great read because rather than a linear history or something, it takes the form of dozens of small stories and facts about different aspects of railway history in Britain and technical information. And what I wanted to know is, where did the idea for doing a book in this format come from?
I've had the idea for some time, actually, and I originally proposed a book that was full of stories written by other people for lots of reasons that never got off the ground. And so I decided that I'd do it myself, and you've seen the result. It's just a sort of random mix of what I consider very interesting stories about railways, including some of my own personal stories.
Yeah, and there's definitely a few common themes going through the book, such as your own personal stories or concentrating on locomotive builders or the way that the scene was changing in the 50s and 60s as well.
Hmm.
What I was wondering was, who is the intended audience in your mind? Because I would describe myself as a bit of a diehard enthusiast, but I learned plenty of new things reading the book.
Well, I firmly believe that the core audience for my books are people probably who can still remember steam engines, which puts them in their 70s, you know, and you're definitely not in that bracket.
Sometimes I feel it.
They're my core audience. I think they're very faithful, you know. I mean, I just talk to people, and when I tell them that I write about railways, they say, oh, my uncle would love to meet you, or my grandfather would love to meet you. And it's people of that age, I think, that I feel an affinity to. But to have a younger audience as well is just, it's brilliant.
And I think that your book is quite accessible for that reason, that because it's these small factoids and stories, you can open a page at random and learn something new. We'll get onto the different topics in a minute, but how do you write something as nuanced as railway terminology with a broader audience in mind?
There is always a danger of becoming too technical. I like to provide the basics of the technical details, but I mean, there are whole books about, you know, one class of engine. I think people might start yawning if I did too much of that. I write so that it appeals to a much wider audience. I do know, having given talks, I remember giving a talk in Scotland at the Mitchell Library a few years ago, talks about Scotland's lost railways, which I'm very interested in. And then there was like 300 people there in the audience, and the person who was in charge of proceedings said, well, thank you very much, Julian. Can we now have some questions from the audience? And do you know who the first people to put their hands up were? All women. It's really interesting. They were very knowledgeable as well.
That's great. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which means that, I mean, if you can reach more people in that way and broaden the audience, then our hobby has some chance of, you know, succeeding and persevering.
Very much.
So to give the listener an idea of the breadth of topics featured in the book, I pulled a few out at random. So we've got a train that ran on rubber tyres. We've got railways that built reservoirs. The Railway Christmas of 1903. Bradshaw's railway timetables, including probably the most train changes over a two-day period that I've ever seen on a journey.
I made that one up, but I actually used the Bradshaw to show that you could do it.
So I think that was 10 changes over a two-day period going from Linton to Anglesey.
Yeah.
And then one just about steam loco nicknames, not all of them complimentary.
Yeah, exactly.
So a huge variety of topics just within that random list.
I know.
And I think what I liked about these was I always refer to things like this as being a tea break length.
Mm.
You know, you make your cup of tea, you're sitting down, you pull open a page and you want to read something that you want to get something out of it in the length of your tea break. And I also refer to it as pub ammo. You know, you can just come up with something in a pub conversation and say, I've got a fact for you like that.
Yeah.
So what were some of your favourite ones that you pulled out of the book?
it amazes me. And just talking about Britain's railways, let alone anybody else's, how they changed so quickly from, you know, the original Stockton and Darlington Railway. I mean, within 100 years, you know, you had the Flying Scotsman on the LNER. I mean, it's just incredible that the speed of the development of the steam engine was just amazing. And, you know, hats off to the Victorians, who certainly knew how to organise things. Just amazing. I just can't see society being the same as it was. You know, there was so much entrepreneurship.
Yeah, the ruthless competition as well. And it, that goes yeah, ruthless. And it just, absolutely. Everybody spurring each other on to develop things.
Yeah. What they achieved was just amazing. Mm. And the fourth bridge, you look at the fourth bridge and think, wow, even today. And that was completed in 1890. Just incredible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's staggering to think that in the space of 100 years, you did, from the speed of a running horse to yeah. 100 miles an hour in the space of 100 years. It's crazy. So are there any other stories from the book, that feature in the book, that you would pick out as your favourites?
Well, I like them all, but I suppose my favourites are my personal stories. Things like My Local Hero, which is it starts off as a story about the Korean War in early 1951, and then it ends up with the naming of a next Great Western Railway locomotive named after the heroes of the Gloucestershire Regiment. And so I link the two. And I love that story. And just stories about my local station and my day spent train spotting and my journey to Lyme Regis, which I've already told you about. I mean, I go into great detail about that. They're just things you cannot do today, you know. I mean, I do see the occasional train spotter. I must admit that they're quite rare. And I was so lucky to be born when I was born just after the Second World War. And I saw the age of steam with the British Railway standard locomotives being built. And then their demise, their very, very, very rapid demise, and then the introduction of diesels, which now have a big following, don't they?
Well, speaking about the pace of the demise, it's one of the things that I picked out from reading your book. When you're talking about seeing a locomotive, for example, when you're train spotting or travelling behind one, and then by the end of the year, you know, it's baked bean tins, it's gone. Mm. And then going like on the Lyme Regis branch, being pulled by an Ivatt 2MT, and then by the end of that year, it's all diesel hauled and it will never go back. And just week to week, the changes that you're seeing in the motive power, how quickly that all that was swept away and converted over.
Yeah, within a few years, you know, we had the modernization plan in 1955. And if you read that, you would think that they would keep steam locomotives going for probably another 30 years. Most of those British Railway standard locomotives were built in the 1950s. And had a very, very short working life, some of them less than 10 years. Mm. And they could have easily have used them until 1980, perfectly capable of working. But of course, you know, to have steam locomotives on the main network now, apart from the preserve ones, you wouldn't be allowed to do it because of the emission.
Well, how old was that for you, really? Because I know that one of the main selling points of diesel power back in the 1950s and 60s when it was being developed was that it was clean. What was the working environment like around steam engines?
Oh, it's absolutely diabolical. I mean, I've been in lots of engine sheds and they were absolutely disgusting, filthy places, but lovely places to visit. And by chance, you either met a friendly foreman or a foreman who chucked you out. So you usually had to climb through a hole in the fence, you know, and make sure you weren't seen by it. I remember at Salisbury Shed, the only way you could get in was past the foreman's office. As far as I know, there was no way in otherwise. So you had to crawl on all fours below the window so you couldn't see you.
So I'm guessing and he wasn't a friendly one.
No, and I went to Colic Shed 40E in 1965, and we got caught by the foreman and he really threatened us. You know, we had to scarp or quit.
They say you've got to suffer for your art.
It was all very innocent, actually. And my parents, they didn't worry. They didn't have any idea where I was going. I used to save up my dinner money from school. I didn't used to you know, they give me five bob a week for my lunch, but I'd save that for my train trips and skip lunch. And we used to go off from Gloucester, my hometown, to London, go around Stratford Shed, Wilson Shed, Camden Shed, come back home. They weren't any the wiser. I mean, we'd be pretty filthy by then, but
they might have a clue.
Yeah, and what's amazing is that my mum died back in 2000, and my sister and I were going through the contents of her loft, and we found a box. My mum kept everything, and she kept all my Trainspotting notebooks.
And these are what feature in your book, In All Aboard. You do have excerpts from your Trainspotting books from back in the day.
I'll show you them. That's my first ever one, which was probably dates back to about 1957.
Wow, well used.
And it ends up in, this one was 1967.
Well, 67 quite apt, really, wasn't it? Yeah.
You know, steam was disappearing fast, and I went off to art college, and there were other things to interest me, such as Watney's Red Barrel, Players Number 6, Girls, you know, a few distractions.
The standard story with the railway enthusiast, isn't it? The bug bites early on and then it comes back later on. Our first interaction was actually via your Instagram channel with Julian Holland Railways.
Yeah.
Where you publish photos that you've taken on loco sporting trips in your youth, which have been digitized. Yeah. What I especially enjoyed about the book was the way that ties in with the personal experiences that you've had. One of the stories that you recount is an epic day of shed bashing in Wales. Well, I think, could you just explain what shed bashing is to anybody who doesn't know?
Well, it's just visiting as many sheds as you can in one day.
And the objective is to collect as many numbers?
Yeah. I mean, this particular day, which I think was April the 11th, 1963, I set off in the morning. I had to stand by the side of the A38 and wait for a bus that was coming down from Birmingham. It was organised by the Warwickshire Railway Society. And I got on this bus bleary-eyed about 5 o'clock, and off we set. And in that one day, we visited 21 engine sheds in South Wales. And to my horror, the driver forgot to go to one. He missed out Aberbeek, I think it was 88E. So I never went to Aberbeek. But I went to all the sub-sheds like Ferndale and Dowlas, Kai Harris and Glenneath, as well as all the big sheds. And it was just in one day.
21 sheds in a day.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. I mean, how much time is that spent at each one? Were you sprinting between locos?
Well, we were told not to hang around. You know, we would go up and down the rows of locomotives, write them down quickly and get back in the bus and off to the next one. But it was great. And then I did a similar one to Glasgow and Edinburgh, the 29th of March, 64. We went up from Birmingham behind 46256, Sir William Stanier.
Oh, so one of the last, the Ivor Pacifics.
Great. Anyway, we ended up at Glasgow Central about 6 o'clock in the morning, and there was a fleet of buses. There must have been about 400 of us. Again, I think that was all Warwickshire Railway Society. It was organised like an army operation, and we visited all the sheds in Glasgow and Edinburgh. And then we ended up at Waverley Station at sort of 9 o'clock at night, you know, and to be taken back home. I mean, just amazing. And that was in one day. I think I visited 11 sheds, but some of them were very big, like St. Margaret's or Poldy, you know.
Yeah, huge. What was the feeling amongst the group? What was the mix of people in the group as well? Was it all young lads?
Well, I was only about 18 then. There were certainly people a lot older than me, you know, diehards, but we were so bleary-eyed at the end of it.
and what was the feeling during it?
It was fairly serious, actually. Everybody's going around scribbling down the numbers, and again, we didn't have too much time. After we left Waverley, we sort of relaxed then, but everyone was so knackered that they probably wouldn't sleep. In fact, I can't remember whether we came back via the Waverley route or came back and, you know, back onto the West Coast main line. I don't know. I went to sleep. And then Sir William came off at Crewe on the way back, and a Black 5 came on for the rest of the journey back to Birmingham.
And with those Trainspotting expeditions of your youth, is the is one of the aims to not only visit as many sheds as possible, but also individual locomotives. Was it a disappointment to see one more than once, for example?
Well, I mean, in my hometown, I saw, for instance, 1424 every day for years on the Chalfont auto train, or 5017 Gloucestershire Regiment. That was a local engine. I mean, it didn't write them down every time, but you know, I can remember getting very excited towards the end of steam in Gloucester when the summer timetable came in the last 2 years. We had a lot of very strange interlopers from Aston, like Britannias, or Royal Scot class from Sheffield or wherever. You know, I remember walking down the road near my house, and the line went by the side of the road, and this train came down. It was 46100 Royal Scot, and he died. Oh, it was great. It was really exciting. And, you know, I years and years later, I have so many happy memories of it. You know, I could talk about it for days, about all the adventures. I mean, can I tell you the funniest thing I ever did?
Yeah, go for it.
Very, very quickly. This was very late in the day, 1966, I think. I hitchhiked to London with a girlfriend from Cheltenham College of Art at the time. And we were going to go and stay in a friend's house in St. John's Wood. So we got to the flat, and I thought, I don't want to spend the night, you know, drinking whatever. So I said, I'll see you later. So I got down to Euston, caught a train to Rugby behind one of the new AC electrics, got off at Rugby about midnight, walked across Rugby to Rugby Central, because I checked on the timetable first. I was the only passenger to get on the train. I caught the York to Swindon overnight train as far as Woodford Holts. There were no lights there. There was no staff. There was nobody, just me, in the dark, on the platform. And I had to wait for the overnight train coming from Sheffield, I think. The driver looked really astonished when he saw me standing in the gloom on the platform. And I got on the train. And then arrived back at Marylebone at sort of 4:30. Then I caught the first tube to St. John's Wood, got to the flat, and they were still asleep.
So if anyone says, "Where have you been?" He's like, "Well."
And, you know, it's all very innocent as well.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Just great. I remember once when I had a dental appointment. I was working for the Reader's Digest at the time as a book designer in Mayfair. And I said, I may be late in this morning because I've got a dental appointment. Well, after the dentist appointment, I decided I didn't want to go to work. So I caught the tube to Charing Cross. This was from Barnet. And then got on the train to Hastings, sat on the seafront, you know, in the sun, and caught the train back and went back home. Brilliant. You know, didn't go to work.
Well, you know, you've got to recuperate somehow, haven't you?
Of course.
Yeah. With regards to the other stories in the book, in terms of like technical or history aspects of them, how did you go about collecting those stories?
I think they're subjects I've always been interested in, but somehow they didn't fit into any one book. So in a way, they're a miscellany of ideas. It's just things over the years that I've always been interested in GWR auto trains because I used to see them every day. And it's a good place to put. I mean, okay, I expect somebody's written a whole book about them, but a couple of pages in the book is enough for a lot of people.
Mm. I've got my copy here, and it smells great. It smells like new book. You know,
I love the smell.
Like every new book is an adventure that you're about to go on, isn't it? I think that idea of it being miscellany of different stories is its strength. I really love just being able to dip in and out of every subject. Mm. And knowing a little bit about a lot, I think, is just great. And
also, I was very aware that whilst my hometown was Gloucester, and I was really a GWR man, you know, for this book to appeal to as wide an audience as possible, it has to have Wales and Scotland in it, and all things. So I tried to geographically please a lot of people. And Scotland, I mean, part of me still would love to live in Scotland. I love Scotland. I mean, the railways up there, they're very lucky. They didn't lose so many.
Yeah, and lucky enough to still have things like the Jacobite every year, running steam services up through Glenfern and up to Fort William.
That is the most amazing international I went on it a few years ago, and I and my wife at the time were quite the only English people on it.
Oh, really?
There was Americans sitting opposite, there was Koreans, Chinese, Japanese. It's so popular.
Yeah.
Of course, they now run two trains each day because of its popularity.
Well, we actually did it as a Christmas treat a few years ago. We only went up to Glenfinnan and back, but it was still fantastic because I'd never really done any mainline running behind steam before. So it was so exciting for me to be able to do that.
Have you done any mainline running since? Or?
No. And especially not the last 2 years, you know, nothing's been going on, has it?
I know. So. I mean, one of the best rides I ever had on the mainline was about 2008. And we went on the Torbay Express from Bristol.
That's one I've always wanted to do. I used to live at Parson Street Station, right next to the line. I would hear it on the weekends in the morning, thunder past. And I always think, I've got to do that one of these days, and I still haven't got around to doing it.
Yeah, I think it was Tangmere, and the journey along the seafront at Dawlish was just amazing. I mean, it was hurtling along there. Well, it felt like it was hurtling. Checking out all this smoke, whistling all the time, and there was hundreds of people all along the seafront there. Just brilliant.
I think it's fantastic that we're still able to do things like that, to be honest. And it hasn't been eradicated completely. We're so lucky to be able to have mainline steam running in this country.
I mean, I suppose the best journey you could do would be settle in Carlisle behind steam. That's still happening.
Yeah.
You really should have a, travel on that.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, so you say that you were really a big fan of the Great Western because it was one of your local routes, you grew up around it. Was there much factionalism amongst railway enthusiasts depending on where they were based?
Yes, I think there was. If you travelled away from your region to another region, you did get a feeling for that. You know, people who lived in Crewe obviously were very keen on the LMS trains. And likewise in Newcastle, the LNER, you know. As I got a bit older and more adventurous, I managed to sort of spread my wings a bit and go beyond my local area and then sort of, you know, went to Crewe Works back in 1962. Just amazing. I mean, the number of locomotives there. At the same time, they were building some of the Westerns as well, Western Diesel. Yeah, it was great. Then I met a guy on Axminster Station back in 1963, and he happened to come from Gourock in Scotland. Now, his accent was so Scottish, I had to ask him it three times to repeat everything. Anyway, we ended up as pen pals, and he used to write long letters to me about what he'd seen and not me, vice versa. Then the following year, I went up to stay with him and his family, and we got a Freedom of Scotland ticket for, I think it was six guineas for a week.
Fantastic.
And we just travelled everywhere as much as we could, most of it still behind steam. Mm. And the most exciting incident was we were on Carlisle Station. We'd just been round Kingmore and Uppaby. We were due to go back to Glasgow Central on the Royal Scot. And the Royal Scot duly arrived, and there was an English Electric Class 40 on there, and it was taken off because it failed. And guess what? Back down. A very grimy Britannia 7002, Geoffrey Chaucer.
Fantastic.
That took the Royal Scot to Glasgow Central, and I logged the whole journey.
That's one of those fabulous sort of underdog stories of, you know, the grimy outgoing mode of transport replacing the shiny new one.
I logged the journey. It's in my book actually about this. And we got to Glasgow Central an hour late, having achieved an average speed of 42.5 miles an hour, something from Carlisle. But as I say in the book, I'd much rather arrive an hour late behind the steam engine.
Brilliant. And when you were doing these trips and things and you're interacting with the railway staff, what was their attitude towards Trainspotters? So you say the foremans were a bit of a mixed bag as to whether they liked Trainspotters.
Very much.
What were the engine crews like?
Usually very friendly. Very friendly. You could stop and have a chat with them. Sometimes, you know, you weren't supposed to, but they allowed you onto the footplate to have a look around. They were great guys.
Were there any regulars that you knew well?
Yeah, a friend of mine actually was a driver at Horton Road Shed when I was at primary school. He used to drive the Cheltenham Spa Express up to Bannington and back. Great.
after the release of All Aboard, what's next in the pipeline for you?
Well, we're just starting work. I've written it, but we're starting work on the creative side of my next book, which is coming out on the 3rd of March next year, and that's called Britain's Heritage Railways, Then and Now. So what I tried to do is not just to write a book about the heritage railways as we see them today, but what was there, what were they like when they were operating as a proper railway? Mm. So there are sort of before and after pictures.
I love those comparisons.
And yeah. There's the history of the railway line before it closed, and then there's what's going on today. So you get a much bigger picture.
You see a lot of common themes with those kind of things, like the extent and the scale of goods yards, for example, which obviously all swept away. So many of them are car parks now, or for heritage railways, they convert them into workshop space because they've got no centralized workshop like BR used to have. So that's really interesting to see, is the change in land use on heritage railways.
Mm-hmm.
And what's important to them, I mean, now you think about the changing attitudes to transport, a car park is the most important thing they need to have.
Absolutely. Very sad. I mean, my main local heritage railway is West Somerset, and I've quite often gone up there on gala weekends and had a stall, selling a few books and meeting people. You meet the same people each year. They remember you, you know. They buy a copy of the book and I sign it for them. Great.
Magic. Yeah, I mean, where would we be without them? And also, one of the articles in your book is about Die Woodham's scrapyard. And that's something I always think about, is where would the heritage movement be without that man and his scrapyard?
We'd hardly have any steam. I mean, yeah, some were saying, like, going to Die Woodham's. I mean, Flying Scotsman's were bought by Alan Pegler, you know. But without Die Woodham, we wouldn't have so many preserved GWR locomotives there and Bullard Pacifics. Because he had a lot of those as well.
Yeah,
I actually visited the scrapyard back in 63 when I was on my South Wales trip. Pretty amazing. And you look at photographs of some of these locomotives that were standing there, some of them for 20 years, very near the sea with the salt air and everything.
Yeah, I mean, and if you were to describe it to somebody, it's almost the worst place to put them.
You know? Absolutely.
Big hunks of metal next to salty air.
Well, they used to park brand new Alfa Romeos down there as well, somewhere near there, and they had terrible problems with rust. Isn't it amazing? You see these rusting hulks, and then you see them now. And my cousin actually was involved in restoring British India Line at Toddington. The work, I mean, takes years and years and years, and some of the skills are being lost, you know, so... Heritage railways in particular have a real problem because most of the people who are volunteering are quite elderly, and so they need to bring in young blood. They haven't necessarily got all the skills, so they have to learn it through an apprenticeship. You know.
There was one, a series of articles that was written by a volunteer about early days on a preserved railway, and he said about one of the chaps who used to come and help out was just that any imperial measurement of railway infrastructure, signalling equipment and everything like that, he just knew it off the top of his head because he'd always worked around it. And I think that working knowledge is obviously something that's dying out, or, you know, has already gone. And I think that trying to establish that again is one of the biggest uphill challenges. And trying to retain that knowledge in a group of people is so difficult. And yeah, it is one of the biggest challenges that we face.
I mean, I have found when I travel on West Somerset that there are young people coming through as well as volunteers, and they seem to be enjoying themselves. It's quite unusual to see sort of a 19-year-old lad sort of collecting tickets with a smile on his face. You know, he hasn't got his iPhone here.
Yeah, and he's doing it for free. He's doing it voluntarily.
I know, wonderful.
Just to experience it. For myself, it's just being around these machines. I just find it a magical, like, exhilarating experience. And I can only imagine what it was like back in the day.
They're living, aren't they?
Yeah.
The first time I went train spotting, I went to Gloucester Central Station. But I can remember the smell, the oil, the steam, you know, the the smoke, everything, and it's still with me.
Yeah.
You know, and the smells when you went around steam engine shows are just intoxicating.
Quite literally. Where can we find All Aboard on sale?
All Aboard is certainly obviously available on Amazon. I think it was number 2 on the hot releases charts for railway books today. It bodes well for the sales. Obviously, Waterstones. And there's a lot of independent bookshops around still. We've been in touch with them, you know, telling them of the publication of the book. So probably they'll be stocking it too.
And there's that classic phrase, which is available at all good bookshops and some bad ones.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Julian, for joining us on the podcast today. It's been an absolute treat talking to you, and I really enjoyed the book.
Yeah, I must thank you very much, because having an interviewer who gets on with the interviewee so well, I mean, it puts me at ease. You know, I've been interviewed by people who have no knowledge at all of the subject.
Well, I was thinking about wrong-footing you at the beginning by saying, what is a train? Anyway, yes, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye.